What was it like to be a Christian living in Nazi Germany? Why did so many of the churches seemingly cave in to the Nazis? What did Hitler and the Nazis say publicly about Christianity? What did they say privately? Some people today mistakenly call Hitler a Christian. Is there any historical evidence for that, or even a shred of that? Or did he call himself that? Today on Vocal Point, we have a privilege to talk with a man, I think, who knows more about the Nazis and Christianity than anyone alive, perhaps, and he's read the original writings in the German language. His name is Dr. Richard Weikert. He's the author of the excellent book, From Darwin to Hitler, as well as some other studies related to Nazi Germany. Dr. Weikert, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure. So let's get right to it. First of all, what was it like to be a Christian living in Nazi Germany?
Well, first of all, we're going to need to define the word Christian because, of course, Germany had a legacy or tradition of Christianity. About one-third of the population was in the Catholic tradition. About two-thirds was in the Lutheran or Reformed tradition, the Protestant tradition. But many of those, especially in the Protestant part of Germany, had become extremely liberal theologically over the course of the 19th and early 20th century. There were many people, for example, who did not believe in any kind of miraculous events, didn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus, didn't believe in the redemption through Jesus and such, that would have still maybe officially been part of the Protestant Church, would have officially been considered, quote, Christian, but wouldn't have had the kind of identity that I would think you'd have to be identified as a Christian. So that's one thing we need to understand, that a lot of what was going as Christianity in Germany during the period of the Nazi period was not what I would consider biblical Christianity.
Well, and you're using even just basic examples, for example, the resurrection. If somebody denies that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, then biblically we could see 1 Corinthians 15:3-4, Paul is saying, you're not a Christian if you don't believe that. That doesn't mean you're a bad person, but, we're all bad before a holy God, and, you're not within the bounds of historic Christianity, period.
Right. And so if we look at Hitler himself, too, I mean, Hitler at various points makes very clear that he doesn't believe in many of the standard doctrines of Christianity, too, including the resurrection, including the virgin birth. In fact, he actually at times privately ridiculed some of these basic Christian doctrines. There's one particular, I think of, there's one table talk where he goes through and he's really sarcastic about the various Christian doctrines, talking about how God caused people, basically created Adam, caused him to sin, he sort of spins it that way, and then has to send his son later on to redeem it. It's really a sarcastic kind of presentation of basic Christian doctrine. So in that sense, Hitler also didn't imbibe those basic teachings.
When you say table talk, what are you referring to?
Yeah, Hitler, during the last several years of the war, was holed up in his headquarters, and he gave monologues at dinner very often, and these are often referred to as his table talks. Now, unfortunately, the English edition of the table talks is based on a flawed manuscript, but there are a couple of German editions that are considered to be historically reliable.
Wow.
One of them is, they simply call it the monologues of Hitler at the at his headquarters, his army headquarters. So this is what was referred to as a table talk. But these table talks are considered by historians to be authentic. Again, the German editions are considered to be authentic. And in those, Hitler is very anti-Christian in his perspective. He makes very many snide comments about Christianity. He does make a few positive remarks about Jesus, however, but he thought that Jesus was an Aryan who was fighting against the Jews, and one of Hitler's favorite stories that he tells quite a number of times, not only in the table talks but also in other of his speeches and writings, was the story of Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple, because his telling of that story was that Jesus was a great Aryan fighter who was taking the whip and driving those money-grubbing Jews out of the temple.
Wow, isn't that fascinating? Now, if somebody wanted to get their own hands on reliable sources as far as what these monologues that you're talking about, how would they do that?
Well, you'd have to read the German, actually, at this point. As far as I know, there's no English translation, even in the offing, at this point. But you really don't have to do that to find what Hitler thought about Christianity, too. I mean, you can also read Mein Kampf. where Hitler also discusses Christianity. He's not quite as upfront in some of the passages about his anti-Christian attitude because he was wanting to placate the German public. In fact, there's a very interesting passage in Mein Kampf where Hitler refers to a former politician in Austria who was a fairly prominent politician while Hitler was there. He was named Georg von Schönerer. And Schönerer was a pan-German nationalist whom Hitler admired, and Hitler in Mein Kampf says that Schönerer basically had his ideology correct. However, Schönerer led a disastrous campaign against the Catholic Church called the Free from Rome movement in the beginning of the 20th century. And it sent his movement into a tailspin because there were a lot of people who were sympathetic to his pan-German nationalism who were Catholic. I mean, he himself was actually not very sympathetic to Catholicism, obviously, leading this movement against it.
Yeah.
But there were many Austrian Catholics who were put off by that movement. So Hitler, in Mein Kampf, says that this was a huge tactical mistake that Schönerer made. And so he's very careful not to repeat that mistake of trying to alienate people over religion. So Hitler, even in his own book, Mein Kampf, makes clear that for propaganda effect, he's not going to be anti-religious, or at least portray himself as anti-religious.
Mm. Now, every once in a while, there are references, quote-unquote, to the Lord or to Providence. I don't know about the Providence part, but the Lord in Mein Kampf.
Too.
And Providence too? Okay,
oh,
what?
Yes. Providence, Lord, God.
What does that mean to him?
Yeah, well, very interestingly, Hitler does use the term God and Lord and Providence and other ones. In fact, Providence he actually uses maybe even a little more than God and Lord. But he does use those terms rather frequently, but he certainly does not mean by that the Lord Jesus Christ as God. In fact, he specifically rejects that kind of idea that Jesus
or the God of
God.
Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Oh, correct. He's certainly against that because he's against the Jews, right?
Right. Yeah, right, right.
He's totally against the whole Old Testament.
Yeah.
And he mocks Abraham and Moses and talks about Abraham deceived, used deception, and how Abraham sold, in Hitler's telling, basically gave his wife to Pharaoh when he went to Egypt, pimped his wife. It's essentially how Hitler tells it. He's definitely against the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. When he gets down to discussing who this God is and trying to give some definition, he doesn't give us a lot of definition. But there are many times in Mein Kampf and elsewhere in his writings and speeches where he makes clear that he thinks that nature is eternal. And if nature is eternal, that means that it couldn't have been created by any external God, and nature actually becomes God for Hitler. In fact, he does deify nature to such an extent that in Mein Kampf, the English translators actually capitalize the word nature in many contexts. And they do that because they recognize that Hitler is personifying nature and really deifying nature. Now, of course, we can't know if Hitler would have done that himself. The capitalization, of course, in German, you always capitalize every noun. So Natur, the German word for nature, was capitalized, but that has no significance. But interestingly, the translators, and I've looked at a number of translations of Mein Kampf, all of the translators of Mein Kampf do capitalize nature, showing that they see it as being deified.
Wow, isn't that interesting? Listen, before I forget to ask you this, you had referred to one of those table talks, one of the monologues of Hitler, where he was totally belittling the Christian message. I mean, it sounds like something one of our leading skeptics of today would be saying. You know, it'd be an interesting thing to say, hey, you know who said this? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, was that, Richard Dawkins? No, actually, it was Adolf Hitler. But do you know the date offhand of that particular monologue?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay.
Let me say this.
I'd like to know that someday.
This is not just an isolated statement that Hitler made. In the table talks or the monologues, Hitler very frequently, in fact, religion was a very common topic of conversation in those monologues.
Wow.
It's not just that it appears like once or twice or something in a three-year span. We're talking about, every few weeks, at least, or maybe more sometimes, there were conversations about Christianity, many of them very extensive, and Hitler is constantly making negative comments about Christianity.
Well, isn't that fascinating that some people today would mistakenly, maybe purposefully do it, lump Hitler in with the Christian church?
Well, of course, he was baptized as a Catholic. He was confirmed as a Catholic, although there is evidence that he was kind of put off by even at his confirmation. After that point, his father was actually something of a free thinker also. His mother was pretty pious Catholic. And he never renounced his Catholicism, so he was an official member of the Catholic Church to the day of his death. But again, that was for propaganda effect. In fact, in Goebbels' diaries, which are also an excellent source material for showing Hitler's anti-Christian position, some of them have been translated into English, but a lot of them haven't. But Goebbels, in his diaries, talks about how Hitler restrained Goebbels from leaving the church, again, for propaganda reasons, not because of any sympathy for Christianity.
Hey, would you ever consider writing a book where you're basically just doing that translation work of some of these passages and then bringing it to light? I mean, I think that would be a fascinating book, and it would certainly be a major contribution to kind of basically take away this myth once and for all.
Yeah, well, I actually did just a couple of months ago finish up a working manuscript of a book on Hitler's religion.
Oh.
And in that, I do translate quite a number of passages that do explain these different things. So,
can you give me a copy? We'll interview you on it as soon as the book comes out. We'll do whatever we can to promote it.
Yeah. Right now, I'm having some other scholars read it and give me feedback.
Oh, peer review.
I'm probably not going to send it off to a publisher till like next year, so it'll probably come out in 2016, I'm hoping or guessing.
Okay.
Or whatever, but I'd be happy to send you a manuscript if you want to see it.
Absolutely. So tell me, what about the word fate with a capital F? That's a form of deity. It's not, certainly doesn't fit the, you know, Judeo-Christian God. But what about that? He would sometimes use that word fate, didn't he?
Well, the word fate and providence, I think, sort of fit hand in hand here in this context. And Hitler did have a notion of there being some kind of God. He was not an atheist. He did believe there was some kind of God. That's why I peg him as being a pantheist, or at least close to pantheism. In fact, a pantheism is a person who believes that nature is God, and so nature is the same as God. Now, I do think that there's a possibility that Hitler may have been a panentheist, which is a close position to pantheism, but which believes that all of nature is God, but that God also transcends nature to some degree. I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with process theology, but process theology believes in what's called panentheism. And Hitler might have embraced that view, but he certainly believed there was some kind of God, but he does see it as hinged with nature.
Dr. Weicker, what were Hitler's views on fate, as in fate with a capital F? Almost a type of deity, but not quite. Certainly not a Christian God.
Well, yeah, I mean, he did use this notion of a more impersonal kind of fate or providence. He used that term quite a bit, too, and those two terms are connected because Hitler did indeed believe in some kind of God. He did have this vague idea of there being God and nature being somehow either all of that God or part of that God. And so he did have this sense that there was this destiny. In fact, he believed that he himself had this sort of special calling from fate or providence to be the great leader of the German people and such. But he was clearly not an atheist. He clearly did believe in some kind of God or providence, and he believed that there was some kind of guidance of human affairs by that, and that he has a special calling in that sense.
Now, in the book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, by a journalist who was there through the whole process, William Shirer, he explains how Hitler felt that he got his calling to lead the German people by attending all these Wagner operas, which were essentially extolling the old Germanic gods and goddesses.
Yeah, indeed, Hitler was inspired a good deal by Wagner, although interestingly, Hitler later, and maybe even early at the time, it's hard to know exactly when he came to these beliefs, but he actually didn't buy into the neo-paganism. Interestingly, Himmler and Rosenberg, and there were some other in his entourage who were very much into the ancient German gods and goddesses, but Hitler actually spoke against that on a number of occasions, sometimes behind their backs in private conversations and such, and made clear that he really wasn't a big fan of the neo-paganism.
And yet, when he died, before he died, he wanted to make sure that he would die like a Viking, in other words, where his body would be engulfed in the flames of petrol and so forth, and at a time when gas was so scarce in Berlin, they still made provision for that so that his body would be inflamed like that, or at least that's what the plan was, because he wanted to die like a Viking, essentially, as a pagan.
Yeah, well, he was inflamed. That's pretty clear. I'm not sure all of the motivations behind that. One of the interesting things, though, in terms of our conversation about, you know, was Hitler a Christian, he did make a comment one time about he didn't want a Christian cleric within 10 kilometers of his funeral. So he clearly didn't want a Christian funeral.
Huh, interesting. Now, you said you've been writing some books, and I understand there's an upcoming book that you've got on Hitler's religion. Boy, do I look forward to seeing that. But you've been courteous enough to send me a little bit of a taste of that. And one of the things you say is that Hitler wanted to enlist Jesus in the cause of anti-Semitism. How does that work? Hitler was a Jew. Everybody knows that.
You mean Jesus was a Jew? Is that what you meant?
Yeah, Jesus. Jesus was
right.
A Jew. So how could Hitler enlist Jesus in the cause of anti-Semitism?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, very oddly, by the late 19th, early 20th century, there were quite a number of anti-Semites, and Hitler was going to imbibe this view too, who believed that Jesus was indeed not a Jew. They were arguing that Jesus was an Aryan. He grew up in Galilee. They claimed that this was that he was probably fathered by a Roman soldier. They claimed maybe Mary might have had some Jewish blood, but even then, they claimed a lot of the people living in Galilee were Aryans, and so they believed that Jesus was primarily an Aryan. And so when Hitler talked about Jesus, he was not thinking of him as a Jewish prophet. He was thinking of him as an anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic, Aryan fighter who is fighting against Jewish materialism.
Isn't that amazing? In case you're just
amazing.
Yeah, in case you just joined us, we're talking right now with a first-rate scholar. This guy, in my opinion, is the go-to guy when it comes to Hitler, the Nazis, and anything related to the church, but also related to the Holocaust. And his claim to fame really is his classic book, From Darwin to Hitler. His name is Dr. Richard Weikart, and that's spelled W-E-I-K-A-R-T. And Hitler, I understand, said on December 28, 1939, quote unquote, the best way to finish off the churches is to pretend to be a more positive Christian. Your comments on that quote?
Yeah, Hitler was pretending quite often to be a Christian of some sorts. And in fact, one of the things I'm going to do in my book is to show some illustrations, one of which is very telling. There was this one photo that his private photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann, took of him in 1932 as he was coming out of a church in Bremerhaven that shows Hitler with this cross above his head, very, very conspicuous. And in fact, in Richard Stikeman Gall's book, The Holy Reich, where he tries to argue that Nazis were Christians, or at least had a lot of affinities with Christianity, he uses that as his cover photo, his dust jacket photo. And so you see Hitler with this big cross above his head, and sort of like a halo effect or whatever. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, sometime around 1937, or I should say in the 1937 edition of the book that had that photo in it, Hoffman airbrushed out the cross. And so interestingly, Hitler was in the one photo from 1932, Hitler was sort of pretending to be a Christian, so to speak, by having this cross above his head and the showing him leaving this church. And then by 1937, Hitler was wanting to distance himself from that. And Hitler and Hoffman were very close together. I mean, they were constantly in contact. So Hitler was very much managed his photos and stuff. So he clearly was behind that. I mean, it wasn't just Hoffman's decision on his own, clearly. So Hitler had this airbrushed out so that the cross was no longer there, and the caption changed. The caption, the original one, just said Hitler leaving church, and it sort of implies that he was going to a church service. In the new 37 edition, it says Hitler after sightseeing at the historic Marian Church in Bremerhaven. So Hitler clearly by that point was, because he was in power at that point, he had his power solidified by 1937. He didn't need to worry quite as much about what people thought about his Christian convictions. So he sort of distanced himself a little bit more from it by that point. But yeah, he was constantly pretending when he thought he needed to pander to the German public.
And speaking of pretending, I understand that when the Nazi Party was beginning, for example, around 1920, they created this 25-point program. And here's one of the things that it says. This is from Article 24, quote unquote, "We insist upon freedom for all religious confessions in the state, providing they do not endanger its existence or offend the German race's sense of decency and morality. The party as such stands for a positive Christianity without binding itself denominationally to a particular confession. It fights against the Jewish materialistic spirit at home and abroad and believes that any lasting recovery of our people must be based on the spiritual principle, the welfare of the community comes before that of the individual. End of quote. That's very rich, but again, it fits that mode that you're talking about. Try to fool the church people into joining the movement, and then at the right time, you know, then go ahead and work towards the anti-Jewish, anti-Christian goals.
Sure, and of course, one of the clauses you read there was that providing it does not offend the sensibilities. And who gets to determine that? Of course, you know, the Nazi regime is going to be one that determines whether or not some particular religious expression offends the sensibilities, moral sensibilities of the German people. And of course, they did persecute hundreds of pastors and priests under their regime who they thought offended their moral sensibilities.
You know, I was reading from a Time magazine from December of 1980. And it was talking about the concentration camps, but it was talking about all these pastors and priests that were occupying these camps. And it didn't say anything about Jews or, you know, a preponderance of Jews. Were basically pastors and priests that wouldn't go along with Hitler and the Nazis, were they among the first to be incarcerated and sent away to the camps?
No, they weren't the first. Actually, the first were the communists. The communists were the first ones who were persecuted all the way back in February and March of 1933, right after the Nazis came to power. The pastors and priests that didn't go along were generally left alone the first couple of years for the most part, although there were some threats and intimidation tactics on a few occasions. But really, there was not any kind of significant mass arrests of pastors or priests until 1937, when a number of confessing church pastors, several hundred of them, were rounded up. Martin Niemöller being the most prominent. He was the leader of the confessing church, and he was going to spend the rest of his days in the concentration camps. He ultimately survived, however, even though Hitler put him on his hit list. Hitler, in April, a month or so before he, less than a month before he committed suicide, made up a hit list of who he wanted executed, and Niemöller's name was on that list, along with Bonhoeffer and some others. Niemöller survived, though, because his captors, the Americans were sort of knocking on the door, so to speak. Their artillery fire was right in the background and everything, and Niemöller convinced his captors not to execute him, and so he survived. Bonhoeffer, of course, didn't, and there were other pastors and theologians that didn't as well.
Now, Bonhoeffer was killed in part, though, from his own activities, like he joined with Rommel and some others, right, in that attempt to take Hitler's life that's, you know, immortalized in that movie Valkyrie.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct? He was a part of that plot.
Well, actually, Bonhoeffer was originally jailed because he helped some Jews escape from Germany. There was this operation that was run within the Abwehr, the German intelligence, where Bonhoeffer had helped 14 Jews escape, and they had done a bunch of deceptive things to try to cover the tracks, and
wow,
the Gestapo ultimately uncovered that. And that's why he was put in jail initially. He was privy to some of the plots going on, and he had some relatives, his brothers and brother-in-laws, who were very much involved in the plot, very hands-on involved in the plot. He was in jail while a lot of that plotting was going on, though, but he knew about it there. But he was obviously an opponent of the regime. And Hitler decided to have him executed before he
suicide
himself.
So he couldn't have actually, you know, been some sort of active part of that plot then, being in jail and so forth.
Yeah, he was jailed already in early 1943, so no, he was not actually a part of the plot, but he knew about it. They smuggled messages into Bonhoeffer, so he knew the plot was afoot.
I see.
They were able to smuggle messages into him by very cleverly underlining certain letters throughout the books that they would send in to him. They were able to get some books that they were able to give to him. They would underline letters in the books and send secret messages to him.
I see.
So he know something about the plot that was going on.
Right.
Again, his brother and brother-in-law were very key figures in the plotting that was going on.
Now, when you mentioned, you know, Bonhoeffer getting arrested because he helped 14 Jews flee, how about a comment on the Christians, the Gentiles, those who helped Jews? You know, I think that we sometimes forget about them. We know about Corrie ten Boom. We hear about Raoul Wallenberg. We all know about Anne Frank's diary. But you don't think about the Gentile family or person that risked their lives to house Anne Frank and her family.
Yeah, there were many, of course. Pastor Trocmé also in the village of Le Chambon in France was another very prominent one who rescued several thousand Jews through France. And there were Catholic nuns in Warsaw who were helping to get Jews out of the ghetto, especially Jewish children in that instance, out of the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw and such. So there were episodes of that. Of course, on the other hand, there were people, plenty of people who still called themselves Christians who turned the back also to the Jews, unfortunately.
Yeah. I read once that in just the Netherlands alone, something like 50,000 Christians, or at least Gentiles, had risked their lives to hide Jews. Does that sound, does that sound right?
Yeah, there were thousands upon thousands. And Denmark also, Denmark was able to save essentially the vast majority of their Jewish community when they found out that the Nazis were going to round them up. They sent them across. They Danish fishermen and others shipped them across to Sweden. Which took them in.
Which is neutral.
Right.
Yeah, very good. And Switzerland being neutral. By the way, Switzerland being neutral and Sweden being neutral, do you think that if Hitler had been successful in, let's say, finishing off the Soviet Union and taking it over completely and then eventually England and so forth, do you think Switzerland and Sweden would have lasted as neutral countries with Hitler having control of all of Europe? I doubt it.
Probably. And even so, Switzerland in particular was very scared of Hitler. And because of that, they didn't allow Jews into the country. They closed their borders to Jews, for example. And they also laundered a lot of the Jewish gold and Jewish valuables that the Nazis had plundered. So the Swiss were complicit economically in many ways.
Yeah, interesting.
And the Nazis actually, in many ways, it actually was actually convenient for the Nazis to have Switzerland not under their control because they were able to have access to other parts of the world, financial institutions and such. And so the Nazis were able to sort of use that.
So then as far as Jews being saved, Sweden was a much better place. I mean, not that that Sweden officially allowed that, but Sweden played a role of salvation for a lot of Jews in that sense, of saving their lives much more than Switzerland did. How about a comment about Pius XII, the Pope at the time? He gets a bad rap today, and yet it's my understanding he actually saved more Jews than the guy that they made that big movie about, Schindler, with his list.
Yeah, Pius XII, interestingly, did save a lot of Jews surreptitiously. He never made any, what he's been bashed for is that he never made any public kind of statements. And it's hard to know whether public statements would have helped or hurt the cause, and I think that's part of what caused him to hesitate. There were actually the Nazis were threatening Pius, and it does seem that there were some credible threats that the Nazis would take over the Vatican if they thought that Pius was sort of getting out of line, and so that also was probably motivating to some degree. But behind their backs, he was hiding Jews in the Vatican and encouraging help for the Jews in various parts of Europe. Some people have argued, however, that if he'd spoken publicly, then Catholics in other parts of Europe might have been more forthcoming in helping the Jews. We can't know about that, but he certainly did help the Jews behind the backs of the Nazis.
All right. Well, we only have a few moments to remain, and I do want to at least mention your website here, DarwinToHitler.com, and not only mention the previous book that made you famous from Darwin to Hitler, but you have this brand new 14-minute film that's really phenomenal. In fact, I just watched it a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. It's on the biology of the Second Reich, and it shows how Darwinian ideas help basically grease the skids for World War One. And everybody knows, or they should know, that the end of World War One greased the skids for World War Two, and therefore the rise of Hitler. And that's phenomenal. How about a quick comment about that film?
Yeah, the film shows the impact of social Darwinism on the origins of World War One, which were considerable, back and certainly in background causes. And many historians have noted that to some degree. There's controversy over exactly how to weight that. But it was very important, and I have a chapter in my book, From Darwin to Hitler, that discusses that. But even more so, during World War I, there were a lot of people who were spreading social Darwinist ideology, justifying the war, and that then was going to have a big impact on Hitler's ideology, and the ideology, which was going to, of course, bring about World War II, which was even more obviously caused by social Darwinism.
Well, I mean, basically, don't you point out that the Holocaust, especially killing Jews and gypsies and others that were deemed to be, you know, inferior, that was basically Darwinism, you know, brought to the next degree?
Yeah, it was an attempt to try to deal with what they saw as human inferiority of certain peoples, which were, and of course, they identified the Jews as one of those so-called inferior groups. And so it was trying to eliminate them to advance the human species, essentially.
You have, in your little documentary, it closes with this quote from Hitler. The law of selection exists in the world, and the stronger and the healthier has received from nature the right to live. Woe to anyone who is weak, who does not stand his ground. He may not expect help from anyone. DarwinToHitler.com to see the film and to get more information. Dr. Weikart, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Appreciate it, and God bless.